You build the world. The roads, schools and hospitals. That's your work. And we're with you on this journey. Procore, your trusted construction partner. Discover our construction management platform at procore.com.
It's Wednesday, the 7th of February, 2024, and you're listening to Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast. I'm David Taylor, and here to discuss some of the past fortnight's industry news with me is Phil Bishop, who of course writes most of the news. Morning, Phil.
Morning, David. How are things?
Oh, not too bad. I'm having technical problems at the moment.
Oh, blimey.
I'm having to work off two laptops, only one of which belongs to me, so it's all a little bit Heath Robinson at the moment, but we'll persevere and see how we get on.
And you haven't got any young people around to sort it out for you?
No. No. Unfortunately not, no. So, I'm on my own. I'm winging it.
Fingers crossed it all works, because we have got masses to talk about. Wowza, what a week or two it's been in the UK construction industry for big news. And when we had our little conflab, our pre-pod meet yesterday, David, to say, what are we going to talk about tomorrow?
Yes.
Our plans have been slightly blown out of the water, because we absolutely have to mention the news that broke this morning that the board of Redrow has agreed a £2.5 billion takeover offer from Barratt.
Yes.
Which is a mega thing. Now, whether it gets past the competition authorities with... what are they? The top house builder and the number seven house builder, making the house building cartel even more cartelish.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I think it will, because they're going through rough times, sort of rough times. So I think it's going to happen. And it's quite big. It also means 10%. I haven't managed to dig out how many employees the two companies have got between them, but 10% are going to be shown the door.
Oh, are they? I didn't know that. I did notice that it seemed remarkable that that Barratt, which, as you say, is the biggest house builder in the UK, one of the biggest of the big six. I was surprised about that, and I would have thought that the Competitions and Markets Authority would have had something to say about it. But I don't know. I don't know what the percentage of the market Barratt will now command now that it's got Redrow, assuming that it goes through, of course. Of course, there are a myriad smaller house builders around the country, and I imagine that they probably account for a fairly sizable proportion of the total housing output.
A lot less than they did. SME house builders used to be 40% of the market, and they're now about 10 or 12%, I believe.
Right.
So the SMEs are very much struggling to stay in the game. Which is all part of what the CMA is already, Competition and Markets Authority, is already conducting a study of the house building market. And one of the things it's looking at is the extent to which there is a level playing field or not, and that sort of keeps the SMEs out of the game.
Well, yeah, surprising news. I didn't know that was on the cards, so... Yeah, I was taken by surprise. A bit more predictable was the other item we were decided to start off with, which was the final publication of the infrastructure pipeline, which delayed. I think it was due out. Was it in October?
Yeah, I think it's supposed to come out. I don't know. It dates from April 2023 is when the list sort of starts, but. I think it was supposed to come out. It was certainly expected to come out with part of the budget paperwork documents in October. Yeah, or was that November? I can't remember now. But last autumn, and a lot of the industry commentators and people like to comment on things say that we need this pipeline, the infrastructure construction pipeline is terribly important, so we can plan and we know what we're doing, but. It's not a plan at all. It's a list of all the projects they can think of, except for things which are under control of the Scottish and Welsh devolved governments. I don't think there's anything Northern Ireland in there. And whether these things happen or not is up to what the next government decides to do. That's not even up to that.
Yeah.
I mean, we've had the same Conservative government. Okay. Three, four, how many different prime ministers since 2015 or 2019, wherever you want to measure it from. And things have changed, notably, famously, HS2, I mean, that would have been this, of course. You know, the northern leg of HS2, or legs, I should say, was a big, big feature of the pipeline not that long ago. And it's not there anymore. So just because something's in the pipeline doesn't mean say it's going to happen. But I think it's mostly encouraging. I think it's big. It's biggest.
Yeah. It's effectively a wish list, isn't it?
No, I think its real value lies in, if you're a publicly quoted, a listed construction company like a Balfour Beatty or a Morgan Sindall, and you're trying to persuade analysts or potential investors of what a great sector it is to invest in, you can say, look at this, look at all this coming down the road, steaming towards us. We're going to have, you know, X percent share of this. This is what we're going to be doing. So you can invest in us in confidence that there's a long-term business, you know, that you're investing in. There's lots of stuff coming our way. Give us your money. We'll be great. And I think that's the biggest value for this pipeline. I don't think any, you know, plant hire company or tier two, tier three company is going to go, oh, there might be this happening in 10 years' time. I'm going to go out and buy a new digger.
No, quite. Yeah, there might be that happening in 10 years' time. But, you know, what are the chances? We don't know. I mean, as you say, It's nice to be able to show potential investors that there's all this money coming down the road, but really it has no value for anybody else. You can't, as you say, you can't bet against it. It's totally out of anybody's control.
I think it's probably easier to bet against it than to bet for it.
Probably.
Anyway, we're not talking about
that. So that's your pipeline.
And we haven't really unpicked the Redrow Barrett. We might come back to the house builders in due course. The first topic I really want to talk to today, which, I mean, compared to those things, it may not be that big a story, but I think it's the most significant story. Is it a parable? Is that the right word? But it's a tale of our times.
It certainly is.
News yesterday that Weston Homes, Bob Weston, had, after spending 8 or more years trying to put up a £300 million development in the centre of Norwich, they're going to knock down Anglia Square shopping centre and put up a whole new city centre, basically, or town centre. Norwich, city centre.
It's a city, yes, it's a city.
Blocks of flats, new shops, offices, leisure, the whole kit and caboodle. And they've struggled over this one in the past. They had planning permission from the city council back in, 2018 or something. And the then Secretary of State, Robert Jenrick, said, not sure, called it an inquiry. The inquiry inspector said, looks good to us. Yeah, should go ahead. And Jenrick, who, of course, has got form in this thing. I mean, it's ironic that Jenrick's now setting himself up as a kind of a future right-wing leadership contender, you know, free marketeer and all that, when he interfered on this one. And he interfered, of course, famously, the Robert Desmond Westfield printing development that was being ruled out. And he would say, oh, that should go ahead on that one. But he lost that battle. Anyway, Jenrick overruled it and said, no, you can't go ahead. So Weston had to go back to the drawing board and bring out a lower rise. The first one had a 20-story tower in it. And they've come up with a lower rise development, a different sort of development. That went through planning or got outline planning or whatever it's called, intention to grant or whatever it's called. And so that was all going on. All the meantime, of course, all sorts of other horrible things have happened. In terms of COVID and nutrient neutrality. I mean, the COVID thing is not just the fact that there was a delay there. It meant that the whole dynamics of shops, not just of COVID, but also in the intervening time, the online retail, of course, has continued to grow and grow. So the shop stuff has changed, the economics of that. Because of COVID and working from home, the offices stuff, economics of that has changed. So delay, 35% inflation over the past 2 years. And it's just been one thing after another. And you can imagine how frustrated poor old Bob Weston must be. And he just said, sod it, I'm walking away. And he's taken a £7.5 million hit on it. So I managed to catch up with Bob Weston. He was in his car when I managed to track him down yesterday. And I, with his permission, we recorded the interview and agreed that we're going to use it here. And just a short one. And I think it's worth having a little listen to what Bob Weston had to say. I've read the statement that you put out this morning on the Anglia Square development. So, I mean, that kind of explains everything. I just wanted to get in your own words, what happened? What went wrong?
Time has killed it. Yeah, and it's what I mean by time. We should have been started work in 2018. We didn't, because the government called it in and went against the planning inspector and refused it, sent us all back to the drawing board, then got caught up in nutrient neutrality, then got caught up with COVID, caught up with rampant build cost inflation. Time was running out on this thing. It's everything is about time that has now made the scheme unviable. So it has very little margin in the scheme, so therefore almost impossible to finance.
Was it the Homes England funding? You were supposed to get 15 million if you started on time, yeah, but that came down to 7 million. Was that the final deal breaker?
Well, the 7 million bit was the timing of the... It had to be spent by a moment in time, which would have been less than 12 months, and we couldn't spend the money fast enough. So therefore, our estimation was we could only draw down 7 of the 15. So there is a big contributor to the viability. The other one was right at the very beginning, Norwich City Council said, because right from day one, if viability has been majorly difficult, Norwich City Council said they would grant sill relief. That happened just before Christmas, but at the scrutiny committee, whilst they approved phase one and two for 2.4 million, we have to take the view that there's little or zero chance of getting 5.4.
And still being community infrastructure levy, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the policy was put in place 4 years, 5 years ago to allow sill relief on Anglia Square, because the leader of the council at the time, Alan Walters, along with the officers, who have been fantastic, understood how the viability of the scheme works. The massive demolition costs to bring Anglia Square down and redevelop it.
And the demolition hasn't even started yet, has it?
We were due to start demolition next month.
So that's an awful lot of suppliers are going to be disappointed. Your demolition contract, your entire supply chain, so the £300 million project, and it's just gone.
It is just gone. And I've got to write off £7.5 million. And that £7.5 million is only the hard cost. In other words, external payments to other people. That doesn't count all other internal costs. My time, everybody else's time over 8 years. You could put another £2.5 million on it without batting an eyelid. So we're going to lose £10 million walking away.
So what now? Where are you going to focus on your energy on instead?
We have to find opportunities to run our business. But housing output in the UK has been set to fall for the last 3 years. Due to a whole host of reasons. And we just have now got to look for opportunities that are viable. One of the biggest problems across the southeast of England, which is supposedly the rich southeast, basic build costs are starting to outstrip values. So this notion that there's all this money that the developers are making or the landowners are getting is rapidly eroding.
What can be done about it?
It's very difficult to say what's going to be done about it. Why has the build cost gone up so far? Post-COVID, construction costs, inflation run at 35% over an 18-month period. On top of that, you've got another 25% construction cost inflation about changing regulations for the green agenda. And nobody's saying that we shouldn't be doing the green agenda, but you have to look at the unintended consequence. And this is it.
Okay, Bob, thanks very much for your time.
Okay, thanks a lot. Thanks.
All right, cheers. Thanks. So that was me talking to Bob Weston yesterday. I hope the sound quality worked. As I say, he was in his car. But what do you make of all that then, David?
I think it's interesting that he opens with time. He says that time is what killed it. But I actually think that Robert Jenrick has a lot more to answer for, because it was Robert Jenrick who, put the brakes on and actually delayed everything. I don't know what his reasoning was for calling in the scheme. Do you know?
Yeah, it's a 20-story tower. It's a big tower block in the middle of Norwich, which is, I don't know Norwich, but I it keeps coming out high up on these lists of most desirable places to live for all sorts of lifestyle factors and whatever.
Right,
so okay. I believe it's a lovely place. And
yes,
yeah. You know, we've had Maidstone's being trashed by some, not 20-story, but fairly high-rise buildings going up in Maidstone at the moment. And I can right. understand the sensitivities to the people of Norwich not wanting that. So there was that element.
I think I must have misunderstood then, because I got the impression that Jenrick called it in after they'd already redesigned the project to get rid of the tower.
No.
I didn't
know. When second design, Gove was in office as Secretary of State at that time, and he didn't blink.
Okay. Right. Well, I guess the fact that happened obviously was a major obstacle, and there were these time constraints, wasn't there, for the Homes England funding, and they just literally ran out of money. But I think it's quite an indictment on the system itself that
not a
scheme.
I'm just going to say, I just want to say, they didn't so much run out of money, but they run out of ability to make money. I mean, the scheme ceased to be viable, basically, for all sorts of reasons.
Well, that's right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they ran out of time, going back to what Bob Weston said. But it is a shame, because he says that there are no winners. Everybody loses out here. Norwich was clearly very keen to get the project started, and obviously it would have been very good for Weston. Would have provided, I think, about over 2,000 jobs. Was it? Over 2,000 jobs and 1,100 new homes. So, yeah, it would have been a good thing. God knows what they're going to do with that site now.
Well, they'll be back to the drawing board. The City Council will have to find some other developer to come in with some other, maybe just turn Norwich into a data centre.
Yeah, probably. No, I've been to Norwich once. One summer, I sailed there, actually. I was on holiday in the Norfolk Broads, and we sailed into Norwich. And only spent one night there, but it's beautiful weather for a start. It was in the middle of the summer. And I was really struck by how lovely the city was, a really nice place. Obviously, I suppose like any city, any sort of major urban centre, it has its slightly sort of scuzzy areas. And that's inevitable in any place. And clearly, if you've got an area which is looking a bit down at heel, you want to revive it. You want to do the best you can for your community. And that's clearly what this Anglia Square project was designed to do. So I do think it's a real shame that it's been, it's just basically withered on the vine, hasn't it? It's just dead now.
And it won't be the only one. I think there'll be other schemes. Perhaps we should do some digging. There'll be some other schemes which have... are no longer viable, and we'll start hearing more of these schemes going. They're not going to the wall, but just collapsing, just not happening, disappearing.
Yes, so I think that's a real shame, actually. And I don't know if you can hold anybody to account for it, really, when you think about it. The fact that obviously we couldn't have foreseen the COVID outbreak and the disruption that created, nor the materials price. Inflation and the shortage of skills, all the other contributing factors. Bob Weston said, the build costs are beginning to outstrip values. And clearly that's a situation that needs to be reversed. But how do you do it?
Well, funnily enough, I have a solution. Prefabs.
Go on then.
Prefabs, off-site construction. That's the future.
Prefabs, your favourite topic, and the UK's biggest prefab enthusiast, I don't think. So why are you advocating prefabs here?
No. I just thought it was a opportunity that everyone knows that off-site construction, whether we're talking about category 1, 2, 3 or whatever, whether it's off-site prefabricated frames, structural frames, or flat pack kits, or category 1, the whole houses on a, you know, built complete, fully fitted in a factory and lifted into place on site. There has long been consensus, as report after report says, that think this is the future. And we've discussed many times about the issues facing Ilka Homes going under, Legal & General quitting the market, other people, was it Urban Splash? Well, Top Hat is still going. But it's, we've talked a lot about this. The reason why I want to talk about it now is because the House of Lords Built Environment Committee have been getting very interested in what they call it, modern methods of construction, which is a polite name for prefabrication. And this report from the House of Lords basically is saying the government strategy is in, or there is no strategy, the government's approach to modern methods of construction is in disarray. Millions of pounds of public money has been invested, they say, but the money's not been backed by a coherent strategy and a set of measurable objectives. They've been quite tough about it all. One of the things they pointed out was that in the March 2021 budget, which when the Chancellor of the Exchequer was a man called Rishi Sunak, and the Prime Minister was someone called Boris Johnson, different times, eh? The accompanying paperwork to the budget announced that the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government was setting up an MMC task force with £10 million of seed funding to accelerate the delivery of MMC homes in the UK. This is what I'm quoting directly from this March 2021 government document. The task force will consist of world-leading experts from across government and industry to fast-track the adoption of modern methods of construction. It's going to be headquartered in Wolverhampton, and it's basically the government, we're going to sort it all out, folks. We're going to get right behind MMC. Turns out that task force has never met. I don't know if anyone was ever rung up and saying, hey, do you want to join our task force? And people said, no, I'm a bit busy, Gov. Or whether they never even rang anyone up. But it has never met.
I think you should be on it, Phil.
Anyway.
Talk some sense into it.
Michael Gove, who I think might be a listener to this podcast, judging by what he said yesterday, was in front of that committee in the House of Lords yesterday afternoon, Tuesday afternoon this week. And they said, why is the task force never met? And he said, basically, well, quote, I don't believe a task force is necessary in and of itself. He basically said that it was set up under the last Prime Minister but two, he said, and there's been a greater level of grassroots leadership, like the Offsite Alliance, which has started up. So the industry itself is sorting everything else out itself. And the reason why I think he's been listening to the podcast is here's what he told the committee when asked why the prefab housing market didn't appear to be working, why companies were going bust and no one was making any money out of it. Let's have a listen.
I don't have a perfect explanation. I think it's impossible to look at modern methods of construction, the MMC sector, without looking at the overall housing landscape overall and the challenges that builders and developers are facing at the moment. If I were to essay an attempt, I would say that modern methods of construction, in order to succeed economically, companies in that sector would need, given, as you quite rightly pointed out, the benefits, but they would need to have a pipeline of demand, a volume of orders sufficient to ensure that the benefits that can accrue do accrue. It's a classic example of new products on the market, which if they are ordered or if they are being produced in sufficient numbers, if there is sufficient demand for them, can be a worthwhile investment, But without that demand, then the landscape is inevitably more challenging.
So, did those words sound familiar to you, David?
I've heard you say that yourself many times, Phil. Yes, he was basically paraphrasing you. Yeah, and he's right. I think you're... Well, I think you heard it first here, folks. But Gove was basically saying what you've always said.
I'm told by a purchasing expert that the correct term is agile supply. There is a failure in agile supply, which I think means, as I thought when it was explained to me, that meant that the supply chain to the top hats of this world was a problem. But actually, I think this demand, the customers, is the problem. Anyway, it's all wrapped up with agile supply, the inability to shrink and grow as demand mm-hmm. changes. Quick tangent here. Let's go back to our crane days, David. Some listeners might know that David and I both at different times have edited crane lifting machinery magazines. And it was always the parallels between Manitowoc in Wisconsin, USA, and mm-hmm. Liebherr in Germany, both manufacture cranes and refrigeration machinery. Yep. Okay, Manitowoc don't make the fridges anymore. They split those two bits of the company up. But when we were on that magazine, it kind of like they'd be able to, oh, the crane business is down, let's make more fridges, and the fridge business is down, let's make more cranes. And maybe the prefab manufacturers, that they need to have a second thing going on. I mean, Costain started out making coffins, and there was another company, Wernick, started out making wooden baskets.
Chicken coops.
Not the coops, but for moving chicken around.
Oh, really?
wooden crates.
Yeah, okay. I'd forgotten about Manitowoc being in the refrigeration business, although Liebherr fridges are quite well sought after. They're considered a premium product. But yeah, Manitowoc, the first time I went to the States, I got a drink out of a Manitowoc vending machine. And I thought...
Pint of diesel, please.
Yeah. I'm here to talk to them about cranes. Anyway, yeah.
The other curious parallel between German crane manufacturing and Manitowoc again is that where Manitowoc make cranes on the edge of Lake
Michigan,
thank you, in the town of Manitowoc, you've also got in northern Germany what used to be the Krupp factory, then became Grove Crane, which is now part of the Manitowoc Group. Mm-hmm. The Krupp factory, both those two sites were originally submarine munitions plants, and they kind of, you know, move away from wartime. Both those two, the German and the American submarine factories, switched to making cranes. So that was curious. Nothing to do with prefab housing. So let's get back on topic. Sorry. Right. So one of the things that, apart from revealing that the task force had never met, one of the recommendations of the Lords Committee, which I thought was interesting, was they're saying that the if the government wants the sector to be a success, it should look at what's going on overseas more and should ensure that its procurement practices, I'm quoting here, the government should ensure that its procurement practices do not limit the ability of successful MMC companies from around the world in moving into the UK market.
Hmm.
Now, that to me sounds like we failed, get the foreigners in, folks. Which was quite a statement, I think.
Hmm. I mean, on what basis do they assume that the foreigners are better at prefabs? I don't know. Do they make better prefabs in France?
Because there's more of it. I think it's IKEA Scandinavia flat pack stuff.
Yeah.
I don't think it's particularly France. I don't know, but there are countries in the world where prefabrication. I mean, Japan. We've already got the.
Yes, I would have thought Japan.
This Japanese company, whatever they call Suzuki House or whatever,
They've come over here already
with Skanska in joint venture and IKEA. I haven't got details in front of me. I may be muddling things up, but all those names are involved.
Mm.
So, there are foreign companies over here. Similarly, when we've mentioned before, when Bouygues wanted to build a student accommodation block in, was it Brighton, that they put up an off-site manufacturing plant in Morocco to build all the components in Morocco and ship them as a sort of a flat pack kit of parts. So they sort of exported the off-site construction.
I wondered, Phil, if you know, following on from what you and subsequently Michael Gove said about, you know, the fact that you need this pipeline of work, you know, if you're going to mass produce houses, you need to have a, you know, reliable, consistent demand. I wondered if it was something to do with the way the UK housing sector is structured, the fact that, you know, we are famously a nation of homeowners. We don't like to rent, we want to buy homes. So we want to buy a home. And so our house building industry is different from other house building industries. And I looked into this actually just this morning. And in actual fact, you know, although you know, it's received wisdom that we have a higher proportion of home ownership in this country than, say, in Germany, France, Italy, other European countries, or indeed in America. Not necessarily in America. I don't think, in fact, I know that that's not actually the case. In America, they do have a high proportion of ownership. But it seems that actually recently, I saw a report in the I newspaper from a couple of years ago, where they looked into this and they say that actually home ownership in the UK has been in decline for quite a while. And I'll quote, it says, in Britain, about 36% of people rent, 19% privately and 16% in social housing. And according to these 2021 figures, France is very similar with around 35% in rented accommodation, but Germany is higher at 50%. So yes, they do rent more in Germany. But it's very interesting. They spoke to various academics and experts about this. And it seems that, and this won't come as a surprise to many people, that home ownership in the UK is declining largely because people can't afford to buy a home in the UK. And an academic from the London School of Economics made this very, well, a fairly obvious point, really, when you think about it, which is that we've introduced incentives for people to buy their own homes, like, you know, Help to Buy and sort of stamp duty reform and that kind of thing. So we're stimulating demand, but we're not actually doing anything about the supply. Everybody knows that housing supply in the UK is well behind target. And so you get a situation where you've got, you're pumping money into stimulating demand, but you're not actually satisfying that demand. So, you know, that simply isn't workable. And so people can't afford to buy their own homes, even if they want to. So people are being, you know, forced into renting, whether they want to or not. And those who can afford to buy houses can afford to buy houses built by the, you know, the top house builders. They don't need to increase output using modern methods of construction. They can carry on making them the way they want to, the way they always have.
Where modern methods of construction tend to be used the most is in the build-to-rent sector.
Yes.
The, basically,
social housing.
Yeah. Yeah. And private, but yeah. And we had a report this morning on the Construction Index website from the British Property Federation saying that the number of build-to-rent units that have gone up in the UK has just passed 100,000. 100,300 units, an increase of 17% on last year. So build-to-rent construction is still a growth market, and that will help drive demand for off-site construction.
Yeah, I think it's worth mentioning, actually, going back to our previous topic of discussion, is that Western Homes is a great and very successful exponent of prefabrication. I mean, Bob Weston, I spoke to him a couple of years ago after they'd just we've talked about Anglia.
Anglia Square.
Yeah, he was full of high hopes for that at the time, of course. But yeah, Western Homes has two factories building its own sort of proprietary prefabricated system. It's called, I've got it written down here. Well, the company is British Offsite, which is a sister company of Western Homes. And they have this system called Unipanel, which they've been making since 2019. They opened the second factory just 2 years ago. And, you know, they've got this system, which is doing quite well. I mean, obviously not doing quite as well now that they haven't got Anglia Square to build. But, they've developed their own offsite manufacturing method. And as Bob Weston said at the time, they're slightly different from other house builders in that they tend to concentrate on infill developments in city centres like Anglia Square. So brownfield redevelopment, and usually it's high rise or at least multi-storey development, so apartments rather than houses. They're not building, you know, little three-bedroom semis like Barratt or Taylor Wimpey or anybody like that. So they've got a way of making off-site work.
Yeah, but I would call that system build rather than prefab.
Yeah, which I probably think
it's sort of hence these different categories. And it, as I say, I've said many times, it slightly frustrates me that they're all bundled up into this word, this jargon, MMC.
Yes, MMC, yeah.
When most of it's not particularly modern at all. You know, it's just a method.
Yes. Yeah, that is true. Yeah, there's quite a lot of sort of on-site finishing in the Unipanel system. But, it still qualifies as MMC, so presumably Michael Gove would be delighted.
What do you want to talk about next, David?
Well, actually, we had a press release. Was it last week or the week before? From, I can't remember which organisation it was, some industry body, saying that, our carbon, our net zero strategy isn't very good. And the government ought to do something about making net zero measures mandatory for the industry, which was a strange thing to say, because this was basically an industry body saying, we need policing. It was a bit, I know that you also picked up on that point and you asked them about it. Tell us a bit more about that one.
Well, I rather perhaps overly subtly, I hope some readers at least got what I was doing. I illustrated the story that I posted with a small flock of sheep being rounded up by a sheepdog. The Institution of Structural Engineers were leading on this, or leading on the publicity.
That's right, it was them.
They've joined with a coalition of people. I don't know why this didn't come out of the Construction Industry Council, because it's basically Construction Industry Council plus some others, plus the Institution of Civil Engineers, who are no longer part of the Construction Industry Council, which is interesting, and then other sort of greeny people like the UK Green Building Council and UK Architects Declare. They've come together to say, government should act to write down a set of rules or dictate a set of rules for how we should measure embodied carbon in our projects. Basically saying it can't just be left to industry, because industry is proving itself incapable on agreeing on the rules. Someone does it one, we've got a VHS Betamax situation, and we can't let the market take its course. The government should dictate from above what is best and what is right. And to me, the very idea that the government knows better than all of these expert bodies and all of these smart professional people that are saying, we need the government to help us. I just, it frustrates me I think we've come to expect too much of government. There are many things where you should say, no, it's up to, it's our problem, our issue, it's to our benefit that we fix it. We know how to fix it. We are the people that can fix it and can police it, because you're not going to get the work if you don't do it this way, or you're not going to get the badge or the certificate. And I've said it before about the builder's license idea that some people are arguing for. I think a market solution is much preferable. But I'm probably these days being very unfashionable. What do you take on it?
Well, I, I take their point that, you know, obviously we're being told that we've got to reach, you know, net zero by 2050. I think it's still 2050. And that everybody says, all right, we're going to do it this way. And they start doing it their way. And somebody else says, well, we'll do it this way. Everybody finds their own route. Everybody works out their own strategy to meet net zero. And basically it's a free for all. And there's no consistency and there's no agreement about how we should go about this. We need some sort of roadmap, I suppose, to how we should actually achieve net zero. And basically...
But this is not about what to do. This is about how we measure what we do.
How
it's
we
like
measure, yeah.
EPC certificates kind of things.
Yeah. Well, it shouldn't be beyond the wit of the industry, as you say, to actually come up with a strategy and a method for doing it. I mean, people have been producing, you know, key performance indicators for this, that, and the other for many, many years now. And the industry is quite good at doing that sort of thing, measuring and monitoring. I would have thought that they could do it without being told. I mean, the government, after all, is only the government probably for the next 9 months or so, and probably won't be around for very much longer in the guise we have at the moment. So why ask somebody who's here today, gone tomorrow, to produce a way
okay.
of measurement?
I haven't given the full background. They're not. This is not something they've just sent to the government or to Rishi Sunak. They've produced a paper addressed to political parties of all. Sorry, political leaders of all parties.
Oh, that's so, yes. Yeah,
so they're talking to, you know, SNP and Lib Dems for what it's worth, but particularly they're talking to Keir Starmer and his team. So
yeah.
this is not just. This is a wider shout out. They want this to be a manifesto commitment that if Keir Starmer is going to ditch his £28 billion green spending promise, he can at least promise that he'll set down some rules. And people go, oh, green rules, that'd be lovely. So that's what they're asking for. So it would be a cheap win for the Labour Party to put in their manifesto.
Yeah.
But it does rather make you wonder that, it's a pity there isn't something like a construction leadership council to lead on this, isn't it?
Yeah, somebody ought to invent it.
Maybe not.
There was one other story. Are we done with carbon?
I think we should, just to put the other side. Who was it that explained to me why I was wrong? Will Arnold, the head of climate action at the Institution of Structural Engineers, he explains why we do need government intervention on this. He says, quote, without a legally consistent approach to embedded carbon reporting and limits, every project will tackle the problem differently. Professional institutions are working hard to make embodied carbon a core skill in their members. For example, blah, blah, blah. But no matter how skilled the engineer, if embodied carbon remains unregulated, then the reporting and limiting requirements will continue to be different on different projects, costing designers and developers, and ultimately the public, time and money. He's saying that. He might be right. If something's costing time, if there's a market need for something to happen, I think there's probably a market solution. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, that's a fair comment.
Anyway, and finally, any other...
Very interesting story, which came out, was it last week? I think at the end of last week. We've all heard of Dino Rod, haven't we? I mean, we might not have all used their
household
services.
Name. But
household name, Dino Rod. Yeah, they clear block drains. And, you know, and a lot of people are very grateful for that. What I didn't know was that Dino Rod was the brainchild of an American expatriate who settled in the UK, a chap called Jim Zockel. Is that how you pronounce his name? Jim, well, I know Jim, but Zockel, Z-O-C-K-O-L-L. Yeah, who sadly died last year at the age of 93. So he had a good innings and left quite a legacy behind him. He was a flight engineer for, was it TWA, one of the American airlines. He was a flight engineer.
In the days when they had flight engineers, the guy holding the oil cans next to the pilot.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know what a flight engineer does. But I don't think actually you have flight engineers anymore. So
no.
You don't have a bloke in in overalls with a spanner sitting at the back ready to fix it midair. Anyway, he was an engineer and a very imaginative engineer. And he set up this a drain cleaning company in the States. while he was still in the States, I think. But he was over in the UK staying at a hotel which had a catastrophic drain blockage, which meant that they were going to have to cancel their Christmas party. And he said, let me do it. Apparently, the cost of clearing this blockage would have involved taking up the ballroom floor, and it would cost thousands and thousands of pounds.
£1 million, said, according to this.
£1 million, what, in today's money?
In today's money, 40,000 guineas
then. He said, let me do it, and if it doesn't work, I won't charge you. And he did. He did it in 15 minutes using whatever Dynarod uses. I think it's just an electric thing on the end of a long cable. It's probably more sophisticated than that. So that's how Dynarod was born. He married a British woman and settled in Surbiton, I think, sort of southwest London. What I found even more interesting than that was that he actually introduced to the UK the concept of franchising. You know, the American, I didn't realise that franchising was such a recent introduction to the UK. You think about, well, I suppose American chains like McDonald's and KFC and companies like that, which are all franchises. He set up business in the UK, and franchising was already quite well established in the States. And so he decided that he'll try and do the same thing over here, and that's how Dynarod took off. It's a massive business now.
Why we've never heard, say we, I'd never heard of him, you've never heard of him, I suspect. No. Very few listeners had heard of him, Jim Zockel. But he was not only the daddy of Dynarod, he was the daddy of franchising in the UK. Yeah, Dynarod was the founding member of the British Franchise Association in 1977. And as you say, it's actually incorrect, I think, to say that all McDonald's and KFCs are franchises. I think they tend to use a mixed model. There are some
corporate. Oh, do they? Okay.
But they're huge users of the franchising model, as are things like Snappy Snaps and dry cleaning businesses. And they're all sort, you know, franchising is a big deal, a well-established business model. And he sold Dynarod in 2004 for 58 million quid. And instead of, you know, retiring when he would have been in his mid-70s then, in 2004, he'd have been 73, he looked for new brands to bring into the UK with franchises. And he was working right up to the end as chairman of the Zockel Group, apparently, until, you know, just a few weeks shy of his 94th birthday.
Yeah.
And he died on 25th of January last week, week before. So the man is, in business terms, a rock star. And he's not famous is surprising.
Well, he didn't court the publicity, did he? He just did what he did. And, you know, that's why we haven't heard of him.
I suppose it's the brand, you know, as long as the brand is well known, that's all that matters. Keep the value in the brand.
Yeah, absolutely. So, of course, I mean, plenty of other drain cleaning services out there, but nobody as well known or as ubiquitous as Dynarod. They really are, you know, the market leader. So, yeah.
And like Hoover and JCB, it's a generic term, isn't it? You might not mean Dynarod, but you say, oh, you have to get Dynarod out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, yes, well, RIP Jim, but long live Dynarod, I say.
Yes, even if it is now part of Centrica or British Gas or whatever, rather than
the brand's still there
thing. Right, I think we've gone for long enough. I need to go check on the building work that's going on in my house today.
Starting
for 2 weeks. Fingers crossed. I've left them alone for the past couple of hours. I'm sure it's fine. They know what they're doing.
So, when did they start?
9:30 this morning.
Oh, right. Okay. They're very quiet, Phil. You sure they haven't stopped for tea?
I'll go find out. Right. But for another week, peeps, thank you very much for listening. It's been great being with you, as always. And David and I will be back not next Wednesday, because that will be Valentine's Day. And David and I have got big plans on the 14th of February. But we'll be back on the 21st.
Well, not together, of course.
Well, maybe.
Oh, well.
No, we haven't. No, we'll be back on the, all being well, on the 21st of February. So thank you very much indeed. And do get in touch. We always like receiving emails from you. podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. But for another episode, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.